Good evening, everyone. Next week will be our last class of this module, and it's going to be a combined last class and practice day. So it will start earlier and run later. We'll start at 6:30, and we will go until 9 o'clock. Is that right, Don? Okay, thank you.
So welcome. Let's start out with about an hour meditation practice. Everybody ready? Here's the instruction: sit perfectly still and do not move. You can't do it, can you? You would go crazy. But that's, has anybody ever done a Zen session? You have? What do they tell you to do?
Just focus on the breath and just let whatever comes up.
But what do you do with your body?
You have to sit kind of completely still.
Yeah. And if you sit perfectly still for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, what happens to your body?
You kind of tense up a little bit.
It starts screaming at you. I'm serious.
Yeah.
Pretty, you know, we can't sit. That's why the nurses have to come in and move people every half an hour to keep from getting pressure sores. All these Zen practitioners probably have, you know, yeah, pressure sores. But you know, I did. Let's put it this way: anybody who thinks meditation is about escaping and blissing out, yeah, just sit there for 50 minutes and don't move. See how blissed out you are at the end of that. But I will say it will be a very profound experience, because if your commitment is to sit still, which is what we're going to do for about 15 minutes now, if your commitment to yourself is to be perfectly still, and then the voices come in and say, scratch your nose, or move, or shift, but you don't listen to them, you just keep your word. Your commitment to yourself is to just pay attention and don't move, right? And this Buddha back here has not moved in probably 25 years. It's a very good example of a good meditator. So let's see if we can do like him. Sit perfectly still, and you can count the breath, but at some point, just, you know, drop the breathing. And let yourself be aware of whatever dominates your awareness. Not like there's any right thing that you need to be doing right now, okay? This is not like, if we were doing, like, focusing, like, what we call, shamatha, or calm abiding, or concentration practice, or whatever, placement meditation, you might focus your mind on the breath, and then you'd bring it back again and again and again and again. We're not doing that. If you did, analytical meditation, where you were contemplating these, and we'll do a lot of that tonight, where you're contemplating these different aspects of suffering and what it means to be a human being and so forth, you'll be thinking, but this is not that either. This is just allowing your bare awareness to pay attention to whatever's there, and without getting hooked. So the goal, I mean, if you get on some little fantasy trip, you know, and you write a novel, you know, mentally, you miss the boat. If you're watching the novel getting written, that's a different story, isn't it? Because you've got a little space in your mind to not watch it. And you'll notice it. As soon as you start noticing that the mind is distracted, almost always, whatever's there just poof, disappears. Just poofs away. And you're left with being fully present again. So let's give it a shot. See what happens. And if you're sitting in a chair like like I am, you know, you want to sit with your, you really don't, ideally you don't sit back in the chair, but if you're more comfortable, just be comfortable. You'll have plenty of chances in the next 20 minutes to be uncomfortable if you don't move. Okay? So get a nice, stable position, and then we'll go with that. spend a moment just generating the bodhicitta motivation, which distinguishes us in the refuge and bodhicitta formula that we'll recite in a minute. The first line, you know, basically says, I'm a Buddhist. I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then the second line, so that distinguishes people who aren't Buddhists from people who have made a commitment to the practice, to this path. And then the second line distinguishes people who, their motivation for practices, you know, the motivation for practice that, you know, and since everything depends on the motive and the intention, then the only motivation that would get you to enlightenment is one dedicated to that. You know, so wake up one day enlightened, you got to do the work. So we need to know how to generate this enlightened motive, so that all these karmic seeds that we're planting, you know, we're just a big farm here at Kadampa Center where we teach people how to plant seeds for happiness and to help get rid of the ones that cause suffering. It's really good to know that. So the motivation that gets the result we want and has the ability to heal us and eliminate our fear and create the causes for, as they say, the bodhisattvas who practice this path, they go from joy to joy. Think about that. To go from joy to joy. It's pretty cool. Wouldn't that be nice? You know, for us to have that kind of mind. So the motivation said simply is that we are based on not on sentimentality, but on genuine, heartfelt, well thought out and reasoned love and compassion. So it's for all living beings to have something, you know, some feeling for the welfare of all beings. And so based on that love and compassion, we set our aims at supreme enlightenment in order to be able to be a perfect guide to lead all sentient beings from confusion to their own to supreme happiness. And you know, as the Buddha said, if I could take your sins away, I would, but I can't. You know, you have to do the work. You have to train your mind, cultivate your positive qualities, and clean up the mess. The messes, I guess, probably be more accurate. Try to get some feeling for this motivation in your heart. That, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could develop ourselves fully, as much as possible, even potentially in this lifetime, but make as much progress as we can so that we can gradually become better and better able to serve others perfectly and help them achieve their own true supreme state of enlightenment. So we'll do the prayers, page 34. We've got When I was alluding to the refuge and taking refuge in generating bodhicitta, so remember the first two lines distinguish the Buddhist from the non-Buddhist. So, and the second two lines distinguish people who practice the Mahayana motive, which is this intention to get enlightened for the benefit of all beings. So we'll do it three times. We'll do the four measurables, seven in prayer, and short mandala offering, and then we'll be done with this part. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and the other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. All right, so this is immeasurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. These are the topics of these next four lines. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Excuse me. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And the last, the mandala offering. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this is a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam guru retna mandala kamne yata yame. And that just means, that's the Sanskrit for, I send forth this jewel mandala to you precious gurus. I think. Pretty sure. Alright, so now, we're gonna go over here and read our, again, we're planting seeds, aren't we? Remember I said everything we do here at Seat is farming. We're like horticulturists in the mind. You walk in here and you see all these images, seeds get planted in your mind. You see the Buddha images, seeds get planted. We say the prayers, we make positive intentions, we meditate, constantly planting the seeds for happiness. These are the seeds that will ripen. Based on our motive, on our motivation and our intention, you know, these are the seeds that will ripen as happiness. All right, so we'll do the foundation of all good qualities. I think most people have some idea what this prayer, the ones that have been here the whole time, have some idea what this prayer means. So we'll do it. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once, is greatly meaningful and difficult to find again, please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly, day and night, takes its essence. This life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like the shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. Finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me always to be careful to abandon even the slightest of negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. Seeking samsara pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness, and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the pratimoksha vows. Bless me to accomplish this essential practice. Just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Please bless me to see this, train in supreme bodhicitta, and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. Even if I develop only bodhicitta, without practicing the three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. Once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzed the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. Having become a pure vessel by training in the general path, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, the supreme Vajra vehicle. At that time, the basis of accomplishing the two attainments is keeping pure vows and samaya. As I have become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. Then, having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, by practicing with great energy, never giving up the four sessions, please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. Like that, may the gurus who show the noble path and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. Please bless me to pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances, and all my lives, never separated from perfect gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities of the stages and paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. Now, the three principal aspects of the path. So again, we're just planting seeds here. Seeds that will ripen. And seeds so that, mainly so that we can understand the meaning of these words. Remember I said to you, there's different ways. It's a little bit hard to pick. We can go through here and pick out most of the meditation topics in the lower scope. And in the middle scope and so forth. A little bit harder, but not really, in terms of the three principal aspects of the path. Don't get confused by this. It really is all the same stuff, but you got the foundation of all good qualities and everything's in there, but it's not so clearly laid out. And then you've got the three principal aspects of the path, you know, renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view of emptiness. And this is actually, whenever you hear people talk, Dalai Lama, anybody talking about the practice of Tantra, okay, what do you need to understand to practice Tantra? The answer is, you really need to have some heartfelt experience of these three principal aspects of the path. Not that you have to be, fully realized in these things, but we need to have some understanding of it and some feeling for these words, and also we have to be a Buddhist to practice Tantra, which is the most esoteric, most powerful, most transformative practice in all of Tibetan Buddhism. But you got to prepare yourself to succeed, and the preparation is not only having a qualified teacher, but having some understanding of these principal teachings right here. So it's really important. Alright, so we'll start out. I bow down to my perfect gurus, the essential meaning of the victorious ones' teachings, the path blazed by all the holy victors and their sons, the gateway of the fortunate ones desiring liberation. This I shall try to explain as much as I can. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones, fortunate ones, some with a calm mind. Without the complete intention definitely to be free from circling, There is no way to pacify attachment seeking the pleasurable sex in the ocean of circling. Also, by craving for cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. Freedom and endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. By thinking over and over again that actions and their effects are unbetraying, and repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence, attraction to the appearances of future lives is reversed. When, by having trained in that way, there is no arising, even for a second, of attraction to the perfections of cyclic existence, and all day and night the intention seeking liberation arises, then the thought of renunciation has been generated. Even if renunciation has been developed, if it is not possessed by the mind of enlightenment, it does not become the cause of the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment. Therefore, the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. Swept away by the current of four powerful rivers, tied by the tight bonds of karma so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped by the total darkness of ignorance, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings, thinking that all mothers are in such a condition, generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. In short, if, like the mother whose cherished son has fallen into a pit of fire, experiences 1 second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity, your reflection on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear their suffering for even 1 second, and the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort, then you have realized the precious mind of enlightenment. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you've generated renunciation in the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of circling. Therefore, attempt the method to realize dependent arising. One who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena of both cyclic existence, fate beyond sorrow as forever unbetraying, for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. The appearance-dependent relations, which is unbetraying, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they are seen as separate, then one has not realized the Buddha's intent. If these two realizations are happening simultaneously without alternation, and from merely seeing dependent relations completely unbetraying, the definite ascertainment comes that completely destroys the way all objects are apprehended as truly existent. At that time, the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. Furthermore, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize our emptiness manifest in the manner of cause and effect, then you are not captivated by wrong notions holding extreme views. In this way, you realize exactly the vital points of the three principal aspects of the path, resort to seeking solitude, generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish my final goal, my child. I don't know why people never ask me questions, but any questions? I'm not that good a teacher, but rarely when I say, anybody got any questions? It's like, come on, Ron, throw one at me. Anyway, not that I can answer it, but I will. There you go. There's a question.
What are we going to do on the practice?
Good one. Well, we have a 7-page written exam. Just kidding. I could give you the questions now, but I won't. Actually, there is a. I think this is from Rabina's teachings. Actually, come to think of it, it's not going to help you in this. No, I don't think she is. I think she's coming back next year. But there are some things that would be good to know. And I have the quiz here, but. I'll have some things to think about between now and next week. Because really, you know, if those of you who are doing, if you really want to do something, then go online and answer the quiz that Rabina had. I took the quiz, missed a couple, but I did pretty good. We haven't covered everything in that quiz. That's the thing. Unless you've been following along. There's some stuff on Tantra and some other stuff like that and the bodies of the Buddha that you may not understand. But that's not the for me, that's not the purpose of this class. But anyway, let's go ahead now. We've done what we want to do is cover the three scopes, right? So last week we covered the initial scope. Who wants to tell me what those points are of the initial scope? Let me write them down. Bobby, would you write them up down, please? Everybody's got their outlines, so you can. This shouldn't be a lot of guesswork here, but this is the initial scope. The lesser scope is what they're calling it here. So what's the? Let's talk about. We can say precious human rebirth is one of those meditations. We can say that. What's another one? Mm-hmm. Stay aware of death and impermanence. Death is certain. Time of death is uncertain. And how at death nothing but Dharma helps. Okay. Then the next one is what?
Suffering of the joyous realm.
Joyless. The lower realms, the joyless realms. Remember what they were? Hell. Buddhism,
animal realms.
Yep. Hungry ghosts or pretas. The Sanskrit word for hell beings is naraks. The Sanskrit word for hungry ghosts is pretas. And animals are animals. And then the next meditation is... Refuge, British Refuge. Yep, and we're going to do, I'm doing a class on Refuge this summer. It's hard to believe we can stretch it out for 3 or 4 weeks, but we will. But let me say a little bit about Refuge, because it gets swept under the rug. It really does. It doesn't, people don't give it much credit, and most people who come to Kadampa Center, and I'm not being critical of anyone, but most people who come here are like non-joiners, wouldn't you say? It's been my experience over the years, and so the idea of committing to a spiritual path doesn't really fit in if you're a non-joiner. But this is not about Kadampa Center or being a joiner. This is about your mind, and there was a great teacher who lived up in New Jersey many years ago at the Tibetan Buddhist Learning Center. Can't think of his name. Geshe Karchit. No, Tibetan. Anyway, he was Jeffrey Hopkins' guru and Robert Thurman, but I'll think of it in a minute. But anyway, his big thing was refuge. He thought it was so important that people understand the value of a commitment and what the Buddhas were and what, to get a taste of your own potential to be that and what the Dharma is and have some experience of realization of the Dharma in your own mind so you could see your potential to realize the Dharma and get excited about your life. And then the Sangha is the spiritual community. Get some feeling for what it would be like. First of all, you're being supported by the Sangha. you know, when you're in the, at every stage of your practice. But then, you know, to be that kind, you know, to be someone who can, you know, support others, you know, like we do, just coming together, you know, it sounds kind of woo-woo, but you know, just being here in a group together makes it easier, doesn't it? It's hard to study alone. It's hard to meditate alone. It's much easier to come together with other people who want, who sincerely want to study. So, you know, refuge is not anything to take lightly, but it is something. For people that are sincere and think this might actually work for me if I put in enough effort, would want to do that. They would want to make that commitment for their own benefit, not for any, you know, not for Kadampa Center and not for the Buddha, and not for Geshe Gelug or anybody like that. But it is a huge practice, and it opens the door to everything in Buddhism. Otherwise, we're just dabbling, you know, like going to a cocktail party, tasting the hors d'oeuvres, but never having the meal. So this is very important. All right, the next one. What's the last meditation? Laws of karma. What are those four? What are the biggies, the four laws? So karma is definite, which... Another way of saying that is let's see if I got enough watermelon seeds to go around here. Again, yes. Nope, I don't. Yeah, you plant a watermelon seed, what are you going to get? You think you'll get a banana tree? No. You plant this seed and you nurture it, you'll get a watermelon. And if we plant a seed of anger in our mental continuum, we will suffer. You know, any action motivated by hatred, greed, or ignorance. Again, no matter what it is, no matter how, you know, you could do anything. You could be, like I said, stroking a check for $1 million to Kadampa Center, and your motivation would be to look good. You create virtually no positive merit. You know, now if you want to do that, we'd be happy to have your money. But you know, that's not the point. Much more powerful to give $1 with the right motivation than to give a lot of money with the wrong motivation. So, all right, so you plant a seed of kindness or positive, and this is why it's so important to constantly be aware, because every seed counts. Every second, just little tiny acts of kindness or little moments of being mean, you know. You think, I'm not a bad person. Why is this happening to me? You ever been mean? Okay, well, that's why you're being treated like this. What goes around comes around. This is the tree. This is the hard. This is the hardest thing in Buddhism, but it's the best thing. I was telling Robbie the other day, or today, I believe. You know, Lama Zopa said this one time, and after I had my very first Buddhism course, and I've never heard him say it since. Actually, so I keep wondering if I actually heard it. But, you know, he'd been teaching for a whole month at this monastery, you know, in Koh Phan, and there were like 200 Westerners, and, you know, and I was one of those. And, you know, we were, every day we'd be getting up in the morning and meditating and taking notes on from the lectures in the morning and the afternoon, and doing more meditation practice and discussion. It was a very intensive experience for like a month. And when it was all said and done, and this is somebody who's dedicated their lives to, you know, to the Dharma. And he said, none of this may be, you see, it may not be true. He said, not a word of it. It may all be a mistake, an error. So you're going, wow. I hadn't heard him say that all month. But he said it. And then he followed up with, he said, but If you live your life this way, you will be happier. You will not become a problem to the world, you know. And in, from the point of view of karma, it's the teachings say that eventually we will be able to validate the act. It says this about all the teachings, actually. Every word of the Buddha can be validated by an enlightened being as being accurate. But for us, we're not enlightened. So some of these teachings, some of them are quite obvious. Like, for example, the ones we're going on tonight on suffering. There's no doubt that that's true. I mean, if you start thinking about it, although I did see somebody say, well, they didn't really think they were suffering. But if you stick around, well, you know, if you think about it, you know, the way the teachings are presented, it's it does make one think about suffering in a different way. But anyway, what were they talking about? Suffering.
It may not be true.
Oh, it may not be true. So anyway, he said, you know, so the teachings of karma are that way. We can't prove them 100%. But if we live our life as if they are the truth, as I said, sort of creatively align with these teachings, in the same way that we might creatively align with the notion of past and future lifetimes, we can't prove it. I can't prove that. I cannot 100% prove karma. But I do have some experience, personal experience, that I behave myself a lot better when I'm aware of karma. You know, I go, oh my gosh. You know, the other day, what was it? Oh, my youngest one, a lot of you know I have young children. My youngest one and I were out buying birthday presents, and she picked up something that she shouldn't have taken. She just forgot it. And I said, Annabelle, we got to take that back. And she said, no, we don't have to take it back. We can take it back. I said, no, we've got to take it back now. And I said, you know, because we don't want anything bad to happen to us. So, you know, we don't want to steal. But, I mean, that may sound a little bit extreme. But I mean, if we are truly take these teachings to karma to heart, if everybody did, wouldn't need police. Well, you would. But, you know, even if we had wisdom, I think understanding karma with wisdom, with compassion, is a huge help for our mind. And I will say this, and then I'll move on, but it is virtually, I must say it's impossible to develop a calm, peaceful, happy mind when our behavior is all over the place. It's, you know, it's impossible. This is why 2/3 of the teachings of the Buddha have to do with karma and ethics, living ethically. Because that's how the world is constructed. Remember how we talked about emptiness? Right? I'll just splash on that for just a minute. So, you know, there is no objective reality out there independent of my mind labeling it, right? There's no objective reality out there or even the sense of I, is just the mind labeling it based on a combination of a mind and body. You know, these so-called aggregates of the mind and body. The mind labels it, and that's really all there is. But we believe that there's a real I, and we, you know, we get all wrapped up in what I want, and I'm the most important one, and I'm the center of the universe, and we have projections, and we buy in our projections and think our projections are the truth. When it's just our truth, not the truth. It is true for us, but it's not the truth in the big, you know, capital T truth notion. So, where are our projections coming from? Where is our view of the world coming from? You know, if we see ourselves not having friends, not being happy, being stressed out, you know, having issues with depression, having bad relationships, that, you know, whatever. Where is that coming from? You could say it's just happenstance, right? But from the Buddha's perspective, it's coming from conditioning right? Conditioning, we call it karma. The conditioning from the past ripening in this moment, poof, like a projector. We're creating our own our unique reality. That's why we say, for example, that not everybody sees this the same way, and particularly a dog or a baby, because even though we'd all say it's a gong, a dog and a baby wouldn't. If it was a gong from its own side, everybody, even the dog and the baby, would say, oh, that's a gong, you know, or think gong. So there is no objective reality out there that exists independent of my mind labeling it. Where do the labels come from? What's the cause of me seeing my life either working or not working, being happy, seeing myself in paradise, having good relationships, having success in the things that are important to me? Where is it coming from? It's all coming from karma, from conditioning. What is that? Where is that coming from? Where is the positive karma coming from? Good behavior. Ethics. Remember, we define ethics as any action that because, for example, this sounds gross, but if a rapist, you'd say, well, what about a rapist? They're having fun while they're doing their thing. But that's not the point. That's the long-term consequences of an action is what we're looking for, not the short-term, you know, like some sort of, you know, some sort of momentary bliss. That's not what we're talking about. If the long-term consequences of an action lead to suffering, by definition, that action is non-virtue. If the long-term consequences lead to happiness, by definition, that action is. I'm sorry, did I get that wrong? Okay. All right. Virtue leads to happiness. Non-virtue leads to suffering. If you're suffering, it's because you did something non-virtuous. If you're happy, it's because you did something virtuous. So what we want to do is be forced, because we can't change, right? You can't change that, can you? Like right this second, we can't change what we're seeing right now. Correct? Can't change it. Right? It's being forced on us by our karma from the past. Now, we have something to say about the future, about how we react to it and how we behave going forward. But what we want to do is have lots and lots of karma that ripens to force us to see ourselves as being happy, in good relationships, growing old, you know, with a peaceful mind, dying with a peaceful mind, and having, you know, people around us who are happy and supportive and all of that. All of that's karma. It's 110, every bit of it is in Buddhism explained from the perspective of karma. And it's all in our lap to behave, to choose to make good choices. And Robbie is going to, it's a great topic to think about again and again and to meditate on. So that's next module, right, Robbie? Okay. All right. Now we're into the medium scope. So this is kind of it doesn't take long to go through it. But, so the medium scope. All right. So the goal of the medium scope, the goal of the lower scope is what lesser scope is, to get a good rebirth, right? That's the goal of that. The medium scope is to get what? Meditating on the medium scope? Nirvana. Yeah, you want to get nirvana. Nirvana means liberation from suffering. Now, the two kinds, sometimes you see the term lesser and greater nirvana. The lesser nirvana would be the one we're talking about here. The greater nirvana is sometimes equated with enlightenment. But the lesser nirvana is when you're free from suffering. Right, got to tell you a story about the lesser nirvana. So there was this monk. Well, he wasn't a monk before, though. Before he became a monk, his name was, and I may have this story wrong, so don't quote me on this, but his name was Anguimala. Anguimala. That's the best I can say his name. And he was this guy who hung out in a forest, and he killed a lot of people. Like, he had a teacher This is why it's really important to have a good guru too. Because his guru told him, look, you kill 1,000 people and bring me the bones from their right index finger or something like that and make a big necklace out of it, out of those 1,000 bones. Then you will achieve, you know, supreme happiness. So he thought this was the right path. So he was, everybody who came through this forest, he killed. And so the story goes, he had 999 fingers on his necklace. And then guess who was the 1,000th person to walk through the forest? The Buddha. So the Buddha walked through the forest, and Nguimala was like racing, you know, running after him. He's got his, you know, his knife and everything. He's going to go kill the Buddha. And he's running as hard as he can, and the Buddha's just walking mindfully, one step at a time. And Nguimala's sprinting after him. And finally, Nguimala says, stop, stop, so I can kill you. And the Buddha turned around at him and looked at him and said, I have stopped. He said, now why don't you stop? Meaning, I have stopped suffering. I have stopped delusions. Now, why don't you stop? And, you know, fast forward, and Nguimala, you know, chucked his necklace, chucked his guru, became a Buddhist disciple, became a monk. And so he became an arhat, achieved nirvana, which means no suffering, okay? But he had a lot of negative karma. So every time he go to, the story goes, I've heard the story different ways, but it's like every time he went to town with the other monastics on begging rounds and stuff, people would beat the, you know, would stone him and you know, physically hurt him. But the story is, because he was an arahat, he didn't suffer. Okay? Because nirvana means beyond suffering. It means you're no longer clinging. You're no longer clinging to a separate sense of self. You're no longer clinging to, you know, pleasure. You know, you're just in the moment, completely letting go of and accepting whatever comes your way. So, turned out he ended up getting stoned to death eventually. But the important point is, if you achieve nirvana, you may not have purified all your negative karma, but you won't suffer. And in Thailand in particular, that's kind of the goal of practice. And I met some people some monks, when I lived in Thailand for a while, and they said they knew some forest meditators that they thought were arhats, that they had achieved nirvana. And he said they were so blissed out and happy, couldn't believe it. He said he went to see one guy one time, and he asked him why he was crying, and the guy said, I'm crying because I cannot believe how happy I am. That's pretty, wouldn't that be cool? To be so happy, you know, you just can't believe it. But it is possible, because the mind is the source of happiness, that it is possible to achieve these extraordinary levels of contentment and joy and happiness through practicing this path. That's the claim. All right, so that's nirvana. This is the point. These are the meditations on nirvana. Now, you've got to, you know, we've talked a little bit about renunciation, but these first meditations contemplate the nature of our suffering life. So there's the 8, the 6, and the 3. And we're losing somebody here now. Then we're going to talk on suffering. I knew somebody was going to go. Anybody, if anybody else needs to leave, now's a good time. Particularly if you didn't think you were suffering. Now, here's the point of this. This is, I think, a really important point that one teacher told me one time, and I'm passing it on to you. He said, some of these may not resonate with you. For example, some of these different meditations will, but some of them might. And the point is, we really need to get a real sense of that we are suffering, and not that we're trapped in suffering, but we have to come to grips with what it means to be a human being, and that it's basically unsatisfactory, not because we are a human being, but with the kind of minds that we have. It's not satisfying. We can never, ever, ever find a place to rest and say, I'm satisfied with this mind that's deluded. All right? So we're looking for one, two, three, or four, whatever one of these meditations works for you. You know, those are the ones you want to put your effort into. For example, there was one class, one time I taught this, and one lady said, the one that resonated most for her was the suffering of being without a helper. We're born alone, and alone I suffer and die. And that really got her, motivated her, you know? But here they are, the eight dukkhas. All right, the suffering of being born. I'm sure there's some mothers in here and people that have seen childbirth, but we're talking about the baby, you know? Going, having your head molded, looking like a cone head, you know, and being forced through the birth canal is very painful. You don't hear people talk about it because they can't remember it. But actually, there are some hypnotists and stuff that do some things like that called rebirthing, which I'm not real sure about. The suffering of getting old. I'm actually experiencing that today. But so are you. So are you. When is old age? When do you start getting old? Before that. From the moment of conception is when the aging process begins. And it could end in the womb, it could end at birth, it could end, you know, a minute after birth, a week, a year, anytime. So it starts the suffering of getting old, the suffering of getting sick. Most of us have, every now and then somebody will come in to see me and say, I never get sick. I'm going, let me move away from this guy. Well, that lightning is getting ready to strike, you know? Everybody gets sick. If you live long enough, you're going to get sick because these bodies are falling apart. But something will happen. You may not label it sickness, you know, but everybody gets sick. And then the suffering of dying. It's frightening to think that this, who you are, and you can say your name to yourself, I can say my name to me, myself, it's like Don, as I know him, is going to cease to exist. And in the dying, you know, many people die peacefully, but most people, I can't say that I've seen that. And I know in accidents and where people are, you know, dying in traumatic situations, you know, things like that, people are pretty much freaking out, you know, as they're losing, they know that they're going to die, and it's so dying. There is a, and we're not talking about just a quick, you know, there's the quick death, and then there's the drawn out death, and it's scary for people to leave everything behind. But the Tibetans, When they know they're gonna have a fatal illness and stuff, you know what they do? Anybody read about that? They get rid of everything because they don't want to have anything to cling to, right? They don't want to have, you know, I don't want to leave my 401k behind. I don't want to leave my Mercedes behind. I don't want to leave my house behind. I mean, if they have a family, of course, but they don't want to leave their family behind. But they usually try to keep their family away from the dying person, unless they're composed, because they don't want to stir up a lot of negative mind. And there's usually a monk there, or a monastic person, to help that dying person go, you know, die with a peaceful mind. So, you know, there's a lot. Lama Zopa's written so many things about how to help people die peacefully, and we had the most wonderful. I miss Emily so much. Our chaplain died, and bless her heart, from metastatic cancer, and she was so good at helping people, you know, through this dying process. You know, the people that were our members, we still haven't had anybody to step up, have we? I guess Chukila does that. Anyway, the suffering of having to encounter things we don't like again and again. Everybody have that? It'll happen again. Problems are just queuing up. The suffering of having to lose things we do like. That happened? Yeah. In fact, we're gonna lose everything. We're gonna lose everything, including this body, the thing that we pamper the most. Cut the hair, get the teeth whitened, and you know, and get the mani-pedi and the massage. Go to the nice restaurants and buy it good food and nice clothes and just pamper this thing, and then poof, gone. So we're going to lose that. the suffering of trying to get what we want and not being able to. Boy, have I had a taste of that. Haven't we all? I mean, we all, it's just, now, how many people would call this suffering? What some of these things I'm talking about? The suffering of trying to get what you want, what we want, and not being able to. You wouldn't ordinarily think of that as suffering, would you? Or would you? Is that suffering? Yeah, it upsets the mind. You know, we're talking, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, anything that destabilizes the mind is suffering. Okay? A calm, happy, peaceful mind is not suffering. Agitated mind, that's why even, for example, excitement, when we do teachings on mental factors, most of us want excitement, don't we? Well, guess what? That's a negative state of mind, because the mind's agitated and you can't think clearly. Now, does that mean we're going to give up? I'm going to give up my trip to Disney World? No way. You know, my kids want to go, but I mean, you know, we have to understand that excitement is what it is. It does destabilize the mind. It is not the true cause of happiness. Excitement is just excitement. Fun is just fun. But that's not the same thing as joy and peace and wisdom and the kind of calmness that we equate with enlightenment or nirvana, for that matter. All right, trying to go on. Suffering that we have to take of mind and body and other parts. Wait a minute. Did I miss one? Trying to get what we want and not being able to. The suffering that we have taken of mind and body and other parts which must suffer. So that means we've taken a body over and over again, and it's going to suffer. So every lifetime we get a new body. It could be an animal body, could be a hell being body, could be a hungry ghost body, could be a God realm body, but it's a form. We get born somewhere in the six realms of samsara, and we have to take a body, and that body is like a magnet for problems, the ones that we're going over now. So that's the eight. It's good to memorize these, by the way. It helps in your meditation. But in the beginning, you can just do little glance meditations of what these are. The suffering of indefinite, impermanent nature of samsaric pleasures. We're never satisfied. That's what I've been talking a lot about that. Lama Zopa says, the worst suffering of all. Now, does anybody have a quick explanation for why we're never satisfied? Why we're never satisfied? Why can we never be satisfied? Because that's an assertion. Pardon?
Desire. We have a desire for something more.
Okay. We get what we want, but we want more. Why? Pardon?
Like if
As soon as we get something, we want something more. Okay. All right. But that's not exactly... Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, it's not... Yeah, it doesn't last. Whatever we get, it doesn't last. It disappears, and then we're left with wanting more. But there's something even... There's something that's very fundamental to this whole process, too. And that is that everything that we... posit as desirable, we exaggerate. You get what I'm saying? Why do we exaggerate? Do you believe what I'm saying? Why would I, how can I what's causing me to exaggerate the positive qualities of things that are desirable? What's the fundamental mistake that my mind's making to cause me to exaggerate these positive things? Pardon?
Because I don't see it the way it really is.
Yeah. Well, we think that the positive qualities exist over there in that object, completely independent of our mind projecting it. So we exaggerate the positive qualities. Right? We exaggerate because we think, oh, she's so beautiful or he's so handsome. Everybody would see them that way. They're handsome or beautiful from their own side. Right? And so we exaggerate it. Then later on, what do you hear? You're not the person I married. You've changed. You know, we exaggerate it. And this is why, for example, relationships built on attachment are doomed, because nobody can live up to that expectation. We project far more positive qualities on anything that we are addicted to. Could be tobacco, drugs, or people, or rock and roll, sex, whatever you want, food. We project onto things qualities that are way beyond what's there, and then when we, you know, and then we're always disappointed. We're always disappointed. We're never going to be satisfied because we've misconstrued the way they exist, and furthermore, even when we get what we want, it doesn't last. And then we're going, we crave permanence, and it's everything is impermanent. And so we're left with, darn. This, and so Lama Zopa says, of all the suffering in samsara, this is the worst. This is the very worst, the suffering of never being satisfied. Because it's like low-level radiation. It's like low-level radiation. We don't even think about it, but it's always going on. We think it's just how it is. We think it's just normal. But the Buddhas are saying, no, it's not just normal, and we can transcend it. All right, suffering of leaving the body again and again. So, you know, I've heard this one. You know, we get born every time, and then we have to leave the body again and again. So just imagine that a pile of your past corpses, just the bones, forget about the corpses, as high as Mount Everest. Just imagine that. I mean, that's how many bodies we, you know, that's just an example, something to bring to mind, you know. Oh my gosh, we've been born and died and born and died and born and died, taking so many bodies, you know, as big as Mount Everest. And here we are again, right back in samsara, doing the same thing, expecting a different result. But no, we got a chance to get out this time because now we've met the Dharma and we have a chance to practice it. So again, if this one resonates with you, this would be one to put some energy into, this particular meditation. The suffering of leaving the body again and again, the suffering of joining with suffering again and again. So every time you get born, you got to have suffering. We go through the same process of birth, sickness, old age, and death. The suffering of rising and falling. Meeting leads to parting, right? Does. The results of a collection is it's finished. Higher leads to lower, birth leads to death. So, meeting leads to parting, doesn't it? Always leads to parting. Again, leads to, you know, because things are impermanent. The result of a collection is that it has to separate into its parts again. So anything that comes together has to disintegrate the body. Even this earth will not last forever. Higher position leads to lower position. You know? Bill Gates, people don't, you know, respect him like they used to because he's not the head of Microsoft. But, you know, when he's on a deathbed or when he's in a nursing home demented, they really won't care about him at all. And birth leads to death. All right, and then the last one, the suffering of being without a helper. Born alone, I suffer and I die and die. So we're alone. We're fundamentally alone, even though we surround ourselves with people and all that we do to, you know, make ourselves feel good, we are alone. We're born alone. We go through this life alone. And when you when you die, you got to go off alone on your own. I'm trying to remember something my mom said. Besides that, there's something she told my dad. She said something like you know, if you die, I'm not coming after you. I am not going there. So we're alone. We're fundamentally alone. Think about that. That's pretty scary. And we're not trying to scare ourselves into being catatonic. You're not going to drive across out of here without stopping at the stop sign because you're afraid of getting hurt. So we're trying to identify the things, the reality of what it means to be a human being, because the claim is that we can escape the suffering. We can't escape birth, sickness, old age, and death. We can't escape that yet. Now, if you get enlightened, actually, in the Theravada tradition, if you achieve nirvana, you escape death. It's called the deathless state. But let's just say, for ordinary beings, it's not going to happen. We're not going to escape birth, being born and getting old and sick and dying. We're not going to. But what we can do is escape the suffering associated with these or diminish it until we reach a point where we've been able to transcend even death. And then the last sufferings were the three dukkhas, which everybody remembers from last time, right? What are you looking for? Oh. Well, I wonder why they put only five there.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, there you go. I wonder if they took one from the eight and put it there. One, two, three, four, five.
I don't think five. 17 and two. Why do they separate them like
this? Because they like to make lists. They're all suffering. Well, you know, the point, there's probably an answer to this, but I don't have it on my fingertips. But, you know, normally when we talk about suffering, we talk about the three sufferings. You know, we talk about the suffering of pain, right? Any obvious, easy to see, don't have to be a rocket scientist, that's sickness, old age and death, depression, getting cut, breaking your leg, being suicidal, being stressed out, having your marriage dissolve, having, you know, your car, being in a car accident, being in the hospital. All the obvious suffering is the suffering of suffering. Easy to see. Suffering of change, we don't want to see it. Hard to see, because we don't want to see it, because it's everything that we now label pleasure and happiness, sort of. Yeah, because everything that we now think of as the cause of happiness is impermanent. It doesn't last. Relationships don't last. Pleasurable experiences don't last. Good books don't last. Jobs don't last. People don't last. Everything is impermanent. Right? And so the suffering of change is like, it's like what the Buddha's saying is, he's not saying pleasure's not pleasure. And happiness isn't happiness. It's just it doesn't last. It always leaves us like drinking salt water. You know, we were talking about it a moment ago about being dissatisfied. So you really need to think about that one. And the last one is the most important one to think about. And it's called the pervasive suffering. And that one, there's a whole class on that. I'm going to wind this up in a minute. There's a whole class on this pervasive suffering. It's called Samsara Nirvana. And Robbie taught it last time. I end up getting asked to do it. But it's about the wheel of life. And how we're born and die again and again and again. You know, and it's, the wheel of life is driven by ignorance and attachment and craving, and anyway, it is, you know, there's birth and sickness and old age and death, and it's just how we perpetuate through greed, hatred, and ignorance, these three poisonous states of mind. We perpetually get reborn and die again in samsara for countless lifetimes, and it's a little bit hard to buy that, you know, but in the beginning, it's important to at least be open to the possibility. And the way that it's been explained to me, if you get it, if you understand pervasive suffering, and it's more subtle than the suffering of suffering or the suffering of change. It's more subtle. It's like if you have a large burn on your arm, right? And then you pour, and it hurts. Oh, you go, oh God, that thing hurts so bad. And then you pour some tepid water over it, you know? And you go, oh God, it feels so good. It's just some dialing down of what the pain of that burn, you know, just dialing it down a little bit so you go, wow, that feels so good. That gets labeled happiness in this world, doesn't it? A decrease in our suffering gets labeled happiness. But the underlying problem is the burn. The underlying problem is that's the pervasive suffering. We cannot, with the kind of minds we have, we can't get away from it. We will always be a magnet for suffering until we can purify our negative karma and cultivate, you know, the causes for nirvana, or liberation and enlightenment. All right, now I think we have to quit. Wait a minute, I'll just say these other ones briefly, because these are the, then we'll do the higher training next time. Then contemplate the causes of our suffering, and these are all just the poisonous states of mind. Desire, also, you know, sometimes you hear greed, desire, anger or ill will, pride, ignorance. We're not talking about just the, you know, not knowing the square root of 340. We're talking about an active misknowing of reality, destructive thoughts, ignorance of our own nature, belief in the two extremes that things don't exist or that they exist permanently, belief in one's wrong views are the best, believe in an excessive spiritual practices, and belief in a wrong worldview. So that is the middle scope. So we reviewed the lower scope or the lesser scope, and we've covered the middle scope. So if you want to do meditations on these this week, you know, you can sit down and just do glance meditation of the lesser scope, those topics, and then when you get to the middle scope, spend some time, maybe one day do the eight dukkhas, and the next day glance at those, but, you know, do the eight dukkhas and then glance at the other ones, and then the next time glance at the eight and focus on the six, and then the next time do the three, like that. And just, you want to familiarize yourself with the steps of the path. It's really important to memorize these points. If you ever want to do a meditation retreat on it. If we had some time, we could spend like 3 days going over these topics, and it's so energizing. But nobody has time anymore to do this. But one day maybe we will again. But it's very, very, very helpful to do that. Okay, I'm gonna stop talking. So let's take, close your eyes for just a minute and let the... So we have done some serious gardening, farming today, tonight. You know, we came here, could be so many other places, but I know that you came here, you know, to stop your own suffering, and at some level, you like the idea of helping others, and wouldn't that be great if I could stop my own suffering and help others? That'd be so, you know, that would really be cool. So we'll just acknowledge, rejoice in the fact that we've done this work, and planted these seeds that will definitely ripen at some point in the future. And let's do the dedication, Shanti Deva's dedication prayer on 246 in the Go prayer book. Okay. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, attain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of thy merit. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, may find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth. The weak with sorrow find sorrow. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So good work, everyone. Thank you for being here and putting the effort in.